Second Samuel is kind of easy to find. It's right behind First Samuel. I know for many women, to hear the word directed toward them, mother, is probably some of the sweetest music that you would ever hear. I remember the first time that Damaris said, "Daddy." Son, my heart melted. That was an awesome thing. Then the realization of what that meant began to settle in on me. The responsibilities that go with mommy or daddy, they're heavy. There's all kind of moms in the Bible that I could have spoken on this morning. But I believe that the Holy Spirit led me in a specific direction. I have never spoken on this lady, this mother. I've alluded to her, I believe, one time. In the 40-some-odd years that I've been pastoring, preaching. So in 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 10, Rizpah, daughter of Aiya, took sackcloth and spread it out for her, for herself. On a rock. From the beginning of harvest till the rain poured down from heaven on the bodies, she did not let the birds touch them by day or the wild animal by night. It's a strange, very unusual verse. Text, event. This story is torn from the pages of the reign of David. It's a page that's blotted with what to us seems superstition or cruelty or even revenge. Yet it's a page that is so totally and beautifully illuminated by a moving story of a mother's love and devotion and faithfulness. One of the greatest that's ever been written. If you sit down and read this event and ponder all that it stands for and what it means. Every time I would sit down and read this and start centering in on it, I would weep. Because I've sat with mothers that have lost children. Mothers that have had heartbreak. And I see them all in this story. By nature, David was a generous and noble man. He was the king chosen by God. The first king that was chosen by God and anointed over his people. When he received the news of Saul death. Instead of rejoicing. Now, we know that Saul tried to kill David. We know that Saul hated David. Saul was the king that was chosen by the people. David was the king chosen by God. And Saul hated David. And David had to run and hide, because Saul would have killed him if he could. So we would think that when David heard that Saul was dead, he would have rejoiced. But that's not what he did. He began to pour out his soul in praise of Saul for the virtues that he possessed. In spite of all the faults, all of the mistakes, David upheld Saul, and he loved Jonathan, his friend. Had David followed the example of other kings, he would have killed all the followers and all the family of Saul. But instead, he summons his men, his ministers, and he asked the question in 2 Samuel 9, verse 1, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? His heart was so filled with gratitude to God for fulfilling the promise that had been made to him by Samuel, lifting him from the sheepfold to the throne. David was told that there was one of Saul's line still left that they knew about, a lame grandson named Mephibosheth. He was the son of Jonathan. So David sent his men, go get him and bring him back here. He had him brought to the court, and he said to him, 2 Samuel 9, 7, do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all of the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continuously. What an awesome, beautiful act of mercy that began David's reign. That was one of his first official acts. On hearing that he was the king, that Saul was dead. But even with that, David was not free from the customs of his day. And we'll see that played out in the tragedy of Rizpah and her sons. So we have the covenant. Point one. Toward the end of David's reign, there was a drought for 3 years. It was really getting serious. There was great distress and there was suffering. So David inquired of the Lord to learn, why is this going on? What's the reason for the drought and the famine? And the Lord answered him in 2 Samuel 21, 1. It's because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites. The Gibeonites go back to the days of Joshua, when Israel entered into the promised land. And the strongholds of Canaan were falling before the armies of Joshua. The Gibeonites were a part of the Amorites, the Canaanites, in other words. And they feared that they too would die. They watched town after town fall. They understood that we're very close. We're next. And they didn't want to die. So they hatched a plan. They sent a delegation to Joshua. When they arrived in the camp of Israel, the sacks on their mules were old and covered with dust, and their garments was faded and soiled, and their bread was dry and moldy, and their shoes were bound to their feet with rags. They appeared to have traveled a long distance. When Joshua asked them who they were and where they were from, they replied that we came from a far country. Our people have heard of the God of Israel. We have witnessed and seen and heard about the victories that you've had. You've won. Town after town has fallen. So we were sent to enter a treaty and an alliance of peace with you, believing them and buying their story. Joshua made a covenant of peace with them and assured them that no harm would come to them. But at the end of 3 days, it was discovered that they did not come from a far country. They were from a city that was very, very close by. It was revealed that they were Canaanites, and they had been duped and beguiled by this clever scheme that these Canaanites had hatched up. But Joshua had given his word. So he commanded his army to spare the cities of the Gibeonites. And they ordered that those cities, those people, would become cutters of wood and drawers of water for the camp of Israel. In other words, they'll be our servants. You can live, but because you lied and you schemed and you tricked us, you're going to become servants. In his day, the day of Saul, and in his wars against the Amorites, to which the Gibeonites belonged, Saul utterly disregarded the covenant that had been made by Joshua, and he attacked some of those towns, and he slew a large number of those people. And in the sight of God, Saul's deed was a wicked offense, because it was breaking a solemn covenant that had been made with those people. Even though it had been secured by deceit, it was still a covenant, and God still honored it. So that brings us to point two, the sentence. Because this had happened, when David learned that the drought was judgment on Israel because of Saul's offense on the Gibeonites, he summons their leaders, gathered them all around, and they said, "What atonement can we possibly do to make up for Saul's transgressions?" The Gibeonites said, "We do not ask for silver or from gold from Saul's house. Neither do we ask David to punish anybody. All we want is for you to give us, turn over to us, seven sons of Saul. Give us seven of his sons. Second Samuel 21:6. They said to be hung up before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul. David agreed, I'll do it. Their request was not too far out of bounds. So David said, okay. But he spared Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, son of Jonathan, because of his love for Jonathan. So he chose seven other sons. Among them was the two sons of Saul's concubine, Rizpah, one of Saul's wives. These seven sons were delivered to the Gibeonites, who took them out to a hill and hung all seven of them. Can you imagine the sorrow of Rizpah, the dismay that invaded her heart? Can you imagine what it was like? Here she is, a widow, but she's got two sons to take care of her. And one day, army men come and they take those two sons away, saying they're going to be given to the Gibeonites and they're going to be killed. Hanged in Gibeon. No matter how many tears, no matter how much appeal, could not be stopped. The decree of the king had been given, and her sons were dying that day. As soon as the seven sons of Saul had been put to death, Rizpah went out and threw a blanket across her donkey. She left her home and she traveled toward that barren hillside near Gibeah. It was there that the bodies of her two sons were hanging, exposed to the weather, to the birds, and to the beast. There next to the gallows, Rizpah spread sackcloth. The Bible says, on a great rock. And she took up her sad and lonely vigil. A vigil which lasted from the beginning of May, the barley harvest. The beginning of May. We're in May now. Until the first rains came at the end of September. Think about that. From May to September, day and night, she took her stand to defend the bodies of her son. By day, she had a stick, and she would drive off the circling birds and the vultures. She would not allow even one to light. At night, she would light a torch, and she would stand guard so that when the prowling jackals and the wolves came around to eat the bodies, she would protect them. Word of what she was doing in this remarkable devotion, She's known as the faithfulness of motherhood. When the Bible speaks of Rizpah, it's the faithfulness of motherhood. Word spread throughout the land. Even the Gibeonites were touched by the sacrifice of this mom. What a spectacle it must have been when David heard about it. His heart was grieved. I believe it was even torn because of the agony that this mom was going through. So David himself went out to Gibeah, to that hillside. He personally had the bodies of Rizpah's two sons, along with the other five, taken down. Nothing much more than skeletal remains at this point. He gave them an honorable burial. And he took the two sons of Rizpah to the sepulcher, the tomb of Saul's father Kish, in the land of Benjamin, and had them entombed there. Rizpah's very touching, heroic devotion to her sons had arrested the attention and the admiration of those who might read it in the Bible. You can't read this without being stirred to the very pit of your stomach. I believe that it gripped me the way that it did David of old, maybe not to the degree. Over the years, the painters have used their imaginations and their brushes trying to capture that moment. I went online and I pulled up as many of the paintings and the drawings of that particular scene. None of them did justice to it. The poets, the writers, have written their most beautiful prose and lyrics, trying to capture that ordeal that she was going through. The suspended bodies of her sons, her standing there, shooing off the ravens and the vultures, the eagles, standing watch with a torch. A devotion that was unbelievable. Perhaps the most powerful poem that Tennyson ever wrote was his poem entitled Rizpah. I don't have time to do it. I've go and find it. It's a story of a poor English mother whose son had been hanged in chains for robbing mail trains. When she went to see him before he was hanged, the keeper, right in the midst of her visit, said, "Your time is up," and slammed the door. As the door shut, that mother heard from the other side of that door a cry come out from her son, "Oh, mother! Forever!" After that moment, that mother heard that cry over and over and over from that lost boy. Oh, mother. when the mother was released from the insane asylum, where she had been confined because she kept telling everybody she saw, "I hear my son calling." Oh, mother! Over and over and over. Because of that, they had her confined. But later she was released. Night after night, she would slip from her quarters. She'd make her way to the gallows. Because there underneath those gallows was the place that her son had been buried. And one by one, she dug up his bones. And she would trek all the way across to the churchyard. And she would bury those bones in holy ground, close up against the church house wall. In the long accounts of sacrificial motherhood, we know of little or perhaps nothing more moving than that beautiful devotion of Rizpah. Her noble act, that mother's care of her sons, the faithfulness of her intentions. How beautiful, how honorable. It's a nobleness that paints a perfect picture of what a mother's care for her children is. Not only for their bodies, but for their souls. Not all mothers are so strong and courageous and tender and faithful as Rizpah was. I understand that. Not all mothers today are Christians. I understand that too. But yet still, if each one of us, or if all of us, were only to a small degree what our mothers tried to train us to be, or prayed that we would be, or hoped that we would turn out to be, if we only attained a very small portion of that, how great would this world be? How marvelous would our churches be? How wonderful would life be on this planet? So that brings me to point three in a hurry. The appeal. The appeal of this story is that warm memory of mothers. It's an appeal to our gratitude, our respect, our affection for all that they went through. But it's still more than that. So go with me another step. It's appeal to your heart, to your soul. It's an invitation that you take up your cross and godliness, that you raise your worth of living, that you become something more than what you are. It's an invitation to live for everlasting life, for that life to come. It's always reasonable and desirable and necessary when one thinks of a godly mother. And if you ever want to see her again, then you're going to have to go where she is, because she's not going to come where you are. My grandmother, my mom's mom, When she was dying, she looked at every one of her kids and she said, if you ever want to see me again, then you're going to have to come where I'm at, because I can't go where you might go. Other memories may fade, but the memory of a mom. How many memories come back to us of mom's patient toil? I can picture my mom right now standing at the sink washing dishes, singing, bringing in the sheaves, bringing in the sheaves. Every once in a while, she just throw her head back, bringing in the sheaves. When she knew that nobody else was, or she thought nobody else was around. How many times I've heard her pray, Satan, you can't have my boy. I give him to Jesus. Dozens and dozens and dozens of times I've heard her pray that prayer. There's some of us whose mothers are no longer around. I know that. There's some that are. And your mom still sheds tears for you. She still thinks about you. She still prays for you. She still lifts you up before the Lord. How you should cherish that. Oh, how we whose moms are no longer around would like to have them back just for 1 hour. One day. Oh, that would be marvelous. Most of us, the first thing we would do with tears in our eyes, we would apologize for the hurts and the sorrows and the disappointments and the neglect that we passed their way. The carelessness with which we treated them. How I'd like to sit across from my mom one more time. Face to face, and tell her, as I often did in those last couple of years, thank you, Mom, for your love. Thank you for being a good mama. Thank you for showing me Jesus. Even when she had reached the point when she could no longer comprehend even what I was saying, I'd still say it. One of the nurses, well-meaning, I know, she said, you know, your mom don't even know you're here. And I said, yeah, she don't, but I do. That's what matters. And as long as I have a way, as long as I have a breath, I'll be here. Oh, I got so much to say. No time. Thaddeus Stevens, young boy from Vermont, went down to Pennsylvania to make his way, and he rose to distinction in that state. But more than in that state, he rose to distinction in our nation. He rose to such importance that there's many writers, those in places of knowing, says that he was one of the strongest forces in the government, both during and just after the Civil War. The dust of Thaddeus Stevens, the great friend to so many, they lay today in a neglected cemetery in the heart of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Very near That cemetery, dusty and forgotten, overgrown, is a beautiful cemetery in the heart of the city. There in that cemetery lies the grave of Thaddeus Stevens' mother. She did so much for that lame son, born club-footed. She purposed in her heart, he'll rise above this. He can be anything that he wants to be. She raised him with resolve to overcome that handicap, to run the race of life. Great trial, great sacrifice. She provided the means for him to get an education. And recalling what his mother did, Stevens wrote, I really think the greatest pleasure of all my life resulted from my ability to give my mother a farm and 250 acres and occasionally a gold piece, which she loved to take and deposit in the contributor's box at the Baptist church where she attended. Today, you go to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You walk in that cemetery, and you'll find roses blooming on that grave. Because in his last will and testament, Thaddeus Stevens, his mind going tenderly back to that mother's love and that mother's care and that mother's sacrifice, he left a sum of money, the income of which was to forever be used to plant every spring roses and other flowers around her grave. Every one of us sitting in this building right now, we know those godly, all-loving, all-forgiving, all-enduring, all-faithful mothers of ours with warmth. Oh, yeah, there's some that had trials. There's some that's memories are strained. That does not mean that the memory of you will be. You can rise above that. Those that are living, those that are dead, and alive forevermore. And that's where my mama's at. She's walking the streets of glory. Her and my dad, almost every place they went, holding hands. How like Rizpah of old, on that barren rock where her sons were hanging with staff in hand, torch in hand, driving off the birds by day and the beasts by night. How many times our mothers have stood, and some still stand guard over not only our bodies, but our souls, our spirit, our heart. They have the staff of prayer in hand, and that quenchless torch of their love. They're driving away the birds of doubt and unbelief, and by night the beast of evil thoughts and passions that would war against our hearts and seek to pull us into the very depths of hell. Mama stands in the way. You can't have my boy. You can't have my girl. How many thousands of times I've grabbed hands with moms, and we've prayed over a wayward son or a wayward daughter. And through tears, that mom would say, God, bring them home. Let me love them just one more time. The last time I saw my mom, and I closed with this thought, not long before she died, I leaned over that little frail body And I whispered to her, whether she heard me or not, I don't know, and I don't even care. I said, "Thank you, Mom. You have fought the good fight. You've kept the faith. Now it's time for you to go claim your crown, because it's waiting on you. I'll see you soon on the other side, because I've made my reservations. My ticket has been paid for by the blood of Jesus, and I'm ready to go, Mama. And it's all because of you and Daddy." Are you ready to go? Does your mama know that? Maybe while everything is still good, you need to go put your arms around your mom and say, "Thank you. I'm ready for heaven because of you." Bow your heads with me, would you please?